This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking money. Money Out Loud. And it is a great book. It's by Berna Anat, and she's going to be joining me at the bottom of the hour. But right now, I get to talk about something that is really, it's a wonderful book, and I was so happy to be able to get Sarah Driscoll on today, because Sarah Driscoll has written a series. Well, we'll talk about who Sarah is in a minute, but it's a series about FBI canine units. And all of my listeners love dogs and cats. I mean, when I ever have a book on about a dog or that has a dog or a cat in it, they get excited. And this book that we're going to talk about today is called Still Waters. The name of the author is Sarah Driscoll, I think. I'm going to check in a minute. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, so I should call you Sarah?
Well, my real name is Jen Dana. I write under Sarah Driscoll as a pseudonym. I will answer to either.
Okay. I never know what to do in that case because, you know, you're already famous for as Jen because you write a wonderful series there. And then, you know, this series, I love this. I read this book back in October because the book came out in November and I was going to have you in, you know, on the program at that time. But I had so many Christmas books, I was like overwhelmed and I couldn't fit you in. But as I said, I read it in October, and it's set in October, and it's set in Minnesota in the Lake District, which I know very well. So
oh, that's great.
I know how it feels to be in a canoe.
it's a really lovely area.
Oh, it is. And to be there in October is it's a special time of the year. Actually, it's better because the black flies are gone.
That's true.
Definitely. And because in the summertime, it's terrible. I mean, you really have to wear, you know, a veil. It's crazy. But this series is just fantastic. And this is book 7 in this series. Really, I enjoy it so much. I thought, you know, it's so refreshing. And I kept, as I'm reading, I said, well, she's up to book 7 already. Let's see. Why haven't they already picked this up for a series? Because this would be better than Rizzolian Isles. I mean, you put the Isles in. You put the Isles in it, and we could just have to replace Rizzoli with Hawk, and we're all
right.
Set. So why don't you tell us about your main character and about her background, and then, of course, about Hawk. And I he's fantastic. What a dog.
Well, yeah, and a little sort of behind-the-scenes info. Hawk is a black lab because that is the kind of dog that I grew up with. So I have a real sort of affinity towards black labs. There's lots of working dog breeds that are out there, but for search and rescue, Labradors are really good for search and rescue. So I wanted to make him a black lab. But the series stars Meg Jennings, who is, she used to be sort of in an earlier phase in her career, a patrol canine officer with the Richmond Police Department in Virginia. She unfortunately lost that canine in a shooting when they were taking down a suspect. And so she sort of retreats back to her parents' animal rescue, where a puppy, a very sick puppy with parvovirus, is dropped on their doorstep, and that puppy is Hawk. And so she nurses Hawk through this terribly serious illness, and then when he's much better, she trains him to be a search and rescue dog, and then they join the FBI Human Scent Evidence Team, which is a part of a real unit in the FBI, which is part of the Forensic Canine Unit. And so they are live find dogs, and they are off trying to find the lost and, you know, suspects and you know, the injured, the missing. That's what they do.
And as you said, it's a real unit, and they do fantastic work. And so when, as you're writing, I think readers will be so interested in what goes on behind the scenes in search and rescue, or searching out the bad guys. And so it was, I think there was so much, you just weave in all this information in such a lovely way. We learned so much, and I love a book where I come away and I know more about a subject. So
well,
I just thought that was done so well. And of course, you've gotten such wonderful reviews over the years about all your books, and you know that it's just a wonderful series.
Thank you.
So now, and I like the way you start on each, in the beginning of each chapter, you explain some terminology.
Yes, there's an overarching theme for the entire book, but then each sort of little term is directly related to that chapter. So
exactly. So in this case, of course, now she's in in Minnesota in the Lake District in October, and another. This case is a very personal kind of of case.
It becomes a very personal case, yes. They originally go there for, just like any other job, they have to do sort of continuing education. And in this case, their continuing education is learning how to do water searches, which is a new skill for them. But once they get there, things kind of go sideways in a big way.
So when you started with the series, I mean, you weren't with the FBI team, were you
at the start of the series?
Yeah.
Yes, they were like Megan Hawk and Brian and Lacey.
You personally?
Sorry. Oh no. Personally, my background is I'm a scientist.
That's what I thought. You're a scientist, and so
yeah.
I thought it was intriguing that you started this, and you didn't have a particular background in search and rescue. How did you approach the research for this? How did you get together with the FBI? Did you talk to the people there? How did you get this kind
of? We did talk to them a little bit. They're not their media department. They don't like to sort of give out any of their secrets, which I understand. They are the FBI. The first seven books in the series, I wrote with a partner, Anne Vanderlyn, who unfortunately and unexpectedly passed away last summer. Anne was a dog rescuer, and she rescued pit bulls, and at one point she had even up to five of them, trained them to be therapy dogs. One of her dogs she trained to do nose work, so that we really had the protocols around the nose work down, you know, really specifically. So she was really my dog brain. When it came to doing the writing, she was she knew all about dogs and how they ticked and how you would do the sort of the technical aspects. So between the two of us, we sort of put the thing together.
Well, that's I'm sorry to hear about that. I didn't realize that she was gone. Because it's a wonderful series and a wonderful idea, I think. For me, as I'm reading it, I really did keep thinking of it as a series for television, because they need something new. I keep sort of sending messages to the people I know in Los Angeles. I say, oh, please don't make another Wuthering Heights. don't do another Pride and Prejudice. Please don't.
I think it'd be a wonderful TV series because people love animals, and
well, I mean, you've got everything.
It would be a little. Yeah. There's a whole team. There's multiple dogs. I think it would be wonderful.
And you have a wonderful cast of characters, and not everybody's in this book, but including Meg's sister, and and the relationship she has. And I mean, you have great characters.
Well, thank you.
So, you know, I
like the group ensemble. So that always really works for me.
Yeah.
Everybody sort of pitches in, and you have real teamwork.
I think it works beautifully. One of the things, because I hadn't read all your books, so I read this book, and then of course there you mention about Kate, about how Hawk rescues Kate, and that was obviously in a previous book. So then, you know, it's wonderful nowadays with the internet, you can actually go back and read the books before. And I think the way you introduced that, it was so intriguing. So Kate is tied up to a World War One ship, and then Huck saves her. And I thought, well, my gosh, I have to read that book.
Well, yeah, I mean, I try to write each book so that each one can be read as a standalone, but nobody lives in a bubble. So you know, previous cases kind of are alluded to in the book.
Yeah.
That there's lots of previous adventures. If that's, you know, book 7 and book 8 comes out this November.
Yeah, well, I thought, you know, that's just cool to have that, the background, and to sort of build up the characters. And it would just be such a great television series. They need something streaming that's fun. Goes to interesting places, goes to interesting locations. I can tell you one thing: the FBI might be hesitant sometimes to help, but believe me, if you get a television series, they will send an advisor.
I'm sure they probably would.
they would be there in a flash. they would fight over who's going to be the technical advisor for this television series.
Yeah. No, I would love to see that. Maybe someday.
well, you know, you have to just keep, as you're doing, you're writing and writing, and which is a good thing. And so you have plenty of stories here that people can work with and start building. I, as somebody who is, you know, in Hollywood, and sometimes you get projects and they'd say, well, here's something. What do you think? What do you think of? And I say, yeah, that's a good one. And then, of course, in Hollywood, everything takes 30 years. But this is a product. I think there's so much that would go with this one. So now you're a scientist, and you, how did you come to writing?
I just used to write as a teenager. I've always been sort of a voracious reader and sort of picked up writing as a teenager. And then as I got into the later years of high school and university and got married and had two kids and was working in the lab, I just sort of let it go for a while. And then after I'd been working in the lab for about 15 years and my kids were sort of 7 or 8-ish, I just started picking up writing again for fun, and then just sort of got the bit between my teeth and decided to do it professionally.
Well, I mean, that's fantastic. I like what you said, that you were a voracious reader. What were your favorite books growing up?
Well, I mean, I can thank my parents for this. They were both sort of mystery and thriller readers sort of right from the start. So, you know, I grew up on my dad's catalog of Earl Stanley Gardners and Arthur Conan Doyles and all my mother's Agatha Christie's. So I sort of learned, I don't have a master's in fine arts degree. I just learned how to write books from reading the masters.
Well, you don't need a degree in writing to be a great writer. That's for sure. As a matter of fact, sometimes that's not always the best thing. It's really great to have this, just a passion for writing, and it comes through.
Yeah, and so I've always read mysteries and thrillers, and, you know, every time Louise Penny puts out a new book, she's, you know, an auto-buy for me, and, you know, so if you just do a lot of reading and that kind of thing, it teaches you how to write, and it's, you know, I've always had a real love of that kind of book.
Well, of course, as you said, you did work with your friend and somebody who was very important to you. So with your other book, with your other series, you also did some work with somebody.
The Abbott and Lowell Forensic Mysteries, that was also Anne.
Yeah, that was Anne too. Okay.
Yes, that was Anne too. Oh. So I do have a solo series called The NYPD Negotiators. That was written on my own. And now I'm going to be continuing on the FBI Canines on my own.
Well, you know, the Abbott ones are Abbott and Lowell. Now there you get to bring in some of your scientific background.
That's right. That was me sort of, you know, using my scientific background. I work in infectious diseases, so it wasn't indirectly you know, in infectious diseases, but you don't want to do, you don't want to come home at night and write what you do, spend all day doing. That's not too much fun.
Yeah, no, definitely. You definitely don't want to do that. But one of the ones I think in your other series, one that really got me was Lament the Common Bones.
Mm-hmm.
That I love that cover. It's so startling.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, thank you very much.
Well, and it's that's the one, right, about the skeleton, right?
Yes, yeah, that is the one where a skeleton shows up in a research lab, and they realize that it's actually a murder victim.
I had read that a long time ago because I was a medical technologist.
And
so I remember in my lab partner, we had in anatomy class, there was this skeleton hanging, and why I was positioned so that my chair was closest to this skeleton, and this guy my lab partner, he would always come up with creepy stories about who the bones belong to, and he'd tell me these horrific stories of how, you know, the person was. And I, when I first started, I said, oh, no, that's not real bones, they're plastic. they were real bones.
So that book would have really struck a chord with you then.
it did, because I kept, oh, he was creepy. Oh, he was a creepy guy. And at by the end of that class, I wanted to make him into a skeleton. I thought, gee, that'd give me a kick. I mean, he was the kind who was, you know, really obnoxious and always trying to, you know, one-up me and take credit for the projects that we did together. He would have been a great skeleton. that guy's in danger if I ever run into him again.
That's right.
But that's a great book.
Oh, thank you.
And that's the Abbott and Lowell forensic.
That's mysteries. The Abbott and Lowell forensic. Yeah. So that one is a police detective. She's with the Massachusetts State Police. So she's a homicide detective, and she works with a forensic anthropologist.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. So you have two really great series, and as I said, with this one, FBI K-9, it's like sometimes things come along, and you say, this is just perfect timing. And I really think that it's the kind of thing that really streaming should pick up. They would, or even all of regular television. I don't know if anybody watches regular television anymore. But I could see easily a six-episode series. Right off the bat, they have enough material here to make a wonderful streaming series. I get such a kick out of that when I see. And as I said, because I read it in October, and I was thinking about Minnesota, and I was like, I was shivering a little bit, because you get this kind of cold wind that comes, you're on the lake, and a cold wind will come along and sort of get your bones when you're thinking about bones. And then to have a wonderful dog to like this with Hawk, it's a great series.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
So you have that. So you said you have... I thought this was book 7.
No, that is book 7. Book 8 is coming out. Book 8 is called That Others May Live, and it's coming out on November 28th of this year. And it's a book that's sort of loosely based on the Surfside collapse in Florida from 2021. What happens when a building collapses? And for anybody who watched that in real time, the very first teams that hit the pile were the dogs.
Exactly.
And so this book is sort of similar in that case, is that, you know, when something like that happens, if a building collapsed in downtown D.C., the first dogs that would be there would be the human scent evidence team, and they are the first people on site trying to rescue people.
And the wonderful thing about FBI K-9s and for a television series is they go everywhere. They go around the world when they're needed. So this is not a... a simple series, a simple streaming series. I mean, if you get a right deal with the right actor, I mean, they're going to be traveling all over the world to.
Well,
they go
at
to
least
Japan.
Nationally, that was the thinking that went in behind the planning of this series, was that because Abbott Lowell was sort of stuck in one section of Massachusetts because that's where jurisdiction was. the FBI, of course, has jurisdiction all over the United States, so we wanted to sort of be able to throw the net wide when it came to setting.
Well, that's what I thought as I read it, and then I went back and read a couple of the other books. I said, well, yeah, this is... But then it's not just the United States, and I was thinking about that. My goodness, I know that when things happen in Turkey, there's collapse, or there's people lost here, or in Japan, the FBI canines go.
Yeah, well, especially when it's search and rescue. Search and rescue is always the first one out the door.
Yeah.
When a disaster happens.
So we have a lot of work for Hawk.
Yeah.
We can put him to work, and his girlfriend, too.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's nice. You have, as I said, you have a beautiful cast of characters, and I hope that maybe by the time you get back here in November, because this year you're going to come here in November, and we'll talk about book 8. And but if you get news that you get picked up for streaming before that, you have to let me know.
I will let you know.
And you can
for sure.
We can have it breaking news here on Joy on Paper. Okay.
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Okay, and so people should your website is, what is your website?
So they can find me at sarahdriscollauthor.com or at jenjdanna.com.
Okay, everybody. Well, I've just given you two great series. Still Waters is a fantastic book. I love it. Love the cover. And you're right. Hawk is gorgeous. And you'll enjoy this. And then once you read this, you really will go back. I had to go back and start reading from the beginning because it's a great series. Oh, perfect binge reading.
Well, in the books, except for the newest one, the books are all on Kindle Unlimited. So if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, there's all these books that are just yours for the taking.
Okay. Well, that's great. It's been so much fun talking to you today, Sarah Driscoll.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'm thinking about Hawk today. So everybody.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. All right. Now, we're going to play a book buzz. And this book buzz is an old one, but that's the whole point of doing these book buzzes. Because we want to make sure that we keep reminding people. And so we're going to do the Devon Miller book buzz from, this is all the way back to 2021. But the nice thing about these book buzzes is we remind you of great books, of books that you shouldn't forget. And that's a problem sometimes for authors. The books aren't spoken about after the time that they are released. The author gets a month or so. And in this case, you know, I just spoke to Sarah, and Sarah's book was released in November. Of course, I wish I was on 5 days a week. I could have had her back in November because authors get so excited when it's their release date. You know, then after that, they don't get much publicity. So that's what I wanted to do. Do we have her? Do we have the book buzz ready, Big Ed? Or do you want to play a poem?
Actually, I got two poems queued up.
Okay, so let's go ahead and play poems from Jim Lab, because it's almost the end of April, which is Poetry Month.
Lamb's Last Lament by J.S. Lamb. Packs of wolves chewed my bones, then they gnawed my skull, ate my fat, after that, leaving not at all. Didn't mind those brutal acts that left me in despair. What's bothersome was doing that before they said their prayers.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy, and I am back, and I'm just waiting for my next guest to call. She hasn't called in yet. I'm just waiting. They're calling from New York. So we have one more poem from Jim Lamb, and since it is Poetry Month, let's go ahead and play that. And everybody listen.
Hurting Butterflies by J.S. Lamb. Artists experience emotions we all feel. Painting portraits, landscapes, stills. Seizing moments from the sky, like butterflies, playful, platonic, with purpose, expressing feelings in ways no one else can.
Isn't that nice? What I love about poetry is really simple words, simple ideas, can mean so much. And Jim Lamb has a book called Dark Fruit. It's available online on Amazon. You can get the Kindle version and you can read it, and you will. It's an eclectic assortment of poems, and it's a great lesson for all of you that you can take any subject, and he could take any subject. He can take a simple thing about a coffee cup. He can do a simple story about some little moment in time and create such a visual effect in your mind that you can think about it for hours afterwards. And there are just a lovely selection of poems in this book. It's called Dark Fruit. It's available on Amazon as a Kindle version. And just get this book and read a poem a day. You know, just read one poem and just think about it. And then let yourself just imagine what you could do if you decide to write poetry. It's a start. If for those of you who are always thinking about writing, it is a wonderful idea to just start gradually. Put something down on paper. You don't need a computer. You don't need anything special. You just need a piece of paper and a pencil and a pen or a pen. And just write the words down. And you'll be amazed after a while how the words will start coming to you. And you'll say, wow, you know, I can write something. I can write something that means something. And so that's why I always encourage you to do that. And meanwhile, you know, I am waiting for a call, and I think she's going to call in a minute. And it's just a subject that I wanted to bring this book to you because it is a subject that is important. And it is now almost the end of April. And this is for all of you people who make New Year's resolutions. And you say, okay, at the beginning of the year, so you start saying, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to do this. I'm going to clean the closet. Although everybody cleaned their closets during the pandemic. I think that was the biggest thing, which was actually a bad thing to do. I was talking to someone at a donation center, and they said it was just terrible for them because they couldn't take donations from people, and people were throwing things out. It was horrible for the landfills because people were just throwing things out because there was an absolute ban on things going into donation centers for people who need those donations. It was very sad, but now that people have their closets cleaned out, hopefully they might have something still in there that they can sell and actually make money with. But that's what we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. And I think she's on. And I am so happy to welcome Berna Anat to Joy on Paper, because she's going to be screaming money out loud, all the financial stuff no one taught us. Hi, Berna.
Oh, boy. Hi, Patsy. Thank you so much for having me. Hopefully I won't scream like to hurt your audience's ears, but, you know, a little bit yelling.
Yeah, a little bit yelling. Yeah, a little bit yelling. People need to, look, this is an important book, and I was really happy to have it here at the end of April, because I already know people who made resolutions at the beginning of the year to be better with their money, and they haven't been.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And April is Financial Literacy Month, which I think is really good timing, because it's tax season, and it's when everyone starts to look at their wallets and their resolutions like, what did I do? Oh, man.
Well, it was funny. Just before the pandemic, I was talking to a friend, and she was telling me, you know, I was talking about, you know, my travels and going on trips and stuff. And she said, well, you know, I can't afford to do anything. I just can't do anything, you know, and I never have any money. And I said, well, I knew her lifestyle. She, you know, she's a guy who buys something, you know, goes and buys coffee and bagels or something in the morning. And then at lunch, she says, I have to have a healthy lunch. So she goes to a better restaurant, not fast food. She does. So I'm not doing going fast food. So she goes to someplace where she can get a salad and soup. And I said, you know, like, now this is before the pandemic. I said, well, what's the sort of about what do you spend? And that was at that time. It was cheap. It was like $8.50 on the thing. And I said, do you know how much that is in real money? She
real money.
I mean, she had no concept that if she multiplied, if she works 210 days a year, and then she multiplies that, what she gets.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money. These things add up. And we, a lot of the times we have these financial habits that's not even at our budgets necessarily. We just feel like this is part of our life.
Yeah.
Like, we need it. We
need
that little hit.
She
need that lunch.
She needed
that coffee.
She needed that coffee. She needed that croissant. She needed that really healthy lunch. And when I said, that's over $2,000, you could fly to Paris and live for a week. And she was shocked. And I believe she is now taking peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to work now that she's back in the office. So you have to learn.
Oh, boy. You have to learn. Sometimes I think what's difficult about teaching people how to budget, which is something I do, it's difficult to get people to look at the math of it, because we don't want to. We learned not to talk about money. A lot of us deal with it by not looking at our bank accounts for as long as possible, not looking at our credit card statements for as long as possible, because money for us, you know, while giving us stress, it also like enables us to do these little things that make us feel good, which I think there's actually nothing wrong with that at all. I love for people to have their daily croissant, their daily matcha latte, but in the way that I teach money, we can find a way to get control over your budget so that you have dedicated daily croissant money. You have dedicated, you know, weekly facial money or weekly pedicure money, but I want the rest of your money life to be taken care of first, because, you know, if your friend is fine with that, you know, her financial life is aligned in a way that like allows for the everyday croissant, then great. But then you give her the real mass of it, and she looks at her life, she's like, oh my gosh, maybe I'd actually rather go to Paris. Those are very difficult truths for us to confront, because money is very emotional. So that's part of why I wrote this book.
Well, so tell us your experience and how you got involved with this whole subject of money.
I did not at all expect myself to get involved with money. I grew up wanting to write. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write for a magazine. I ended up working in tech. I went through this whole other kind of career journey, and I never meant to do anything financial. It's just that I found myself in my mid-20s, $12,000 of credit card debt, $48,000 of student loan debt, and I was like, okay, there's got to be a way to get a handle on this. So I did what so many millennials do, which is we turn to Google for everything. Just Googling how to budget, how to get out of debt. And then what I learned from there and the community that I built from learning out loud, that's kind of what kicked all of this off. I never meant to get into finance at all. I found myself in it.
Well, you certainly have come a long way from them. The funny thing is, I had a different experience. Because I started at the age of 7, my motto was greed was good. I started a paper route. And at the age of 7, I was the first girl in my town to have a paper route because they didn't let girls do it in those days. And and I started saving my money. And I started saving it.
Wow.
And I saved it. And when I got to the age of 11, and I said to my family, I'm moving to England, which was a little bit, they thought I was a little bit crazy since I was living in northern Michigan, where, and I said, no, I'm saving my money to move to England. Of course, nobody believed me.
Wow.
And then I worked 3 jobs for the rest of my time until I was 21 years old and had $25,000, which was a lot of money in those days, and I moved to England.
Yes. You really did it.
Yeah.
You worked on this goal for, like, 16 years. That's wild.
Yeah, I did.
Just went for it.
So I think you can do a lot for people to get them really to think about money and, you know, where it goes. I was always aware of where it went.
That is so amazing. Do you mind if I ask you where you learned that? I mean, at the age of 7, it's so interesting because I say in the first chapter of my book, there is this study from the University of Cambridge that showed that we actually kind of set our financial foundation between the ages of 7 and 9. And, you know, not a lot of us are learning about money. Probably very little of us are, like, really tangibly learning about money from our parents or caregivers at the age of 7 to 9. But it sounds like you are already an entrepreneur. So I'm curious, like, how did your money brain form in that way?
My family had no money. They had no money to save. They had nothing. We were so poor.
Yeah.
We were like, when they called dirt poor, we were like really, really poor. And we had nothing.
Yeah.
The only books really we had in the house were either comic books or National Geographic because my dad signed up for the thing. That was it. But I just... To tell you the truth, I just love the feel of money. And I said, it's going to do something for me. And I started, but I was really always very generous. I always took a certain percentage to give for my brother to buy candy and for my sister to buy paper dolls. So, you know, I balanced it. And as I grew older and I had more jobs along the way, housekeeping, cleaning, this, that, I always gave a percentage to my mom. So I learned also percentage-wise. It just came to me. I don't know why.
That is magical. I mean, I feel like you have been blessed by the financial gods because you were sort of given this ambition and this, like, eagerness to control money very early, where I think a lot of folks, too, grow up maybe feeling the opposite, you know, that, like, they didn't have a handle on money growing up, whether or not you even had it. Money at all in your family. A lot of us, you know, there's no financial education, very little financial education in our schools. We're not learning a lot of, like, budgeting and saving and debt, much less, like, save $25,000 and move to England. That's like, no one's learning that in high school. You went to your own school of Patsy for financial education, which is so cool. So I wrote this book, Money Out Loud, for those of us who do not have a money brain, you know, who didn't grow up with any kind of financial education, either sort of naturally or in their families. And so I think I want to hear your money book now. I'd like to hear your workbook for.
Well, one of the things that I think.
How to grow a 7-year-old entrepreneur. That to me is incredible.
If people would learn that when you make money, you can do good things with it. Because my brother. he was so sweet. I just wanted, you know, we were so poor. My parents didn't have money to give us those extra things. But my brother was so sweet. I wanted to always get him something. And my sister was so good to me. I always wanted her to have something extra. And I know that my money, at one point when I was working I was doing housekeeping after school, bought her her first cashmere sweater. And I was very proud of that. And I think if people realize that money, you can do good with money.
Yes, you very much can. It's interesting because everybody has a perspective on what money is supposed to be for, and it sounds like you, whether that's from your own like money brain or the way that you saw your family function, a lot of us believe like money is there for to give to other people, right? To take care of the people around us. You know, money should be generously given. Money is for caretaking. And some of us also grew up, you know, believing, oh, money is to be hoarded. Money is to be, you know, not that they don't want to be generous, but like there's scarcity, you know, a lot of fear around money. So I have to keep it. I have to squeeze it as much as possible. And then that kind of carries into our adult lives. Some people believe, oh, money is meant to be spent. And so they become the ones who are impulse buyers and impulse spenders and, you know, kind of always being like, where did my money go? A lot of the time, again, I like to point to in chapter one of my book, that kind of stuff we learned growing up and we learned from the people around us. And so it sounded like you learned to be generous very quickly. I wish my brothers were financially generous with me. They were not like you. They would have never given me money
Like that. I mean, I realized early on they weren't going to have any special treats if I didn't earn them. So it was real easy.
Oh, true.
It was real easy. So tell us how you got out of debt, because you were in big time. I mean, really, you know, that was a lot of money you owed.
Big time. Absolutely. It's so funny because I'm in my hotel room looking out on New York City, and this is exactly where I was when I realized in my early 20s, like, wow, I am not in a good place. Again, $12,000 of credit card debt, $48,000 in student loans. And student loans, I got there because secondary education in this country is ridiculously expensive. So I ended up taking out a lot of loans, and my parents as well. The credit card debt, I was in college, like freshman year. I remember there was a table, like a bank had a table on my college campus, which they can't do anymore, but you could then. And they were basically offering free sweaters if you signed up for a credit card. I didn't know anything about money or credit cards. I just wanted a free sweater. So I was like, oh, great.
Sure.
Free sweater and like $500 limit on this card. Great. And then, you know, adds up. That's how I got there by the time I was in my mid-20s. To start to get out of it, though, you know, like I said before, I started hitting Google. How do I get out of debt? How do you pay down your credit card? How do I budget? Started learning from some financial folks. But as I like to say, the financial world was and still very much is very male, very pale, very stale. I mean, like, the financial education world is just, a lot of it's so boring. It's like these older white dudes. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't relate. So I started kind of putting my own financial education together. And then how I actually got out of debt was, one, I had to figure out my cash flow. I had to understand, what am I earning every month? And is it enough to pay for how much my life costs every month? Luckily, I had gotten a new job around that time. I was getting paid more than I used to. And that's what really got me out of debt fastest. So I really like to stress to folks who are listening who might have debt, I don't want you to think, oh, I'm in debt or I can't get out of debt because I'm bad at money or I'm bad at savings or I'm bad at paying off my bills. It could be that you just simply don't earn enough to be paying off your debt. In order to pay off debt, you need to be making more than what your life costs every month. You need to have extra money at the end of every month, a lot of it, in order to pay off debt quickly. And so I luckily was in a position where I was able to kind of squeeze my life to get more money out of the end of each month, pay off that debt. And it took me about 2.5-3 years to pay off all of my debt entirely, and then also save up to quit my job and travel the world. But it was it went by quickly, but in the midst of it, it felt like a very long slog. It was not easy.
Well, there are a couple of ways that, you know, one, as you said, you have to look at where your money is going. And in my the case of my friend, she had no idea. I mean, she really, well, first of all, they don't teach people how to multiply. You know, multiplication table are really important, kids. And that's one of the first things. They should not let any kid out of, really, after the age of 8, there is no kid who should not be able to do multiplication in their heads. Because that helps when you're in a store and you say, well, I want to buy this and I want to buy, you know, you need to appreciate numbers.
Yes, absolutely. And there are certain numbers that we're not taught how they work in the finance world. You know, you see something like an interest rate or a tax rate. And no one taught me about interest rate in school, but that would have really helped, especially when I was taking out my student loans, when I was, you know, signing up for credit cards. I think a lot of these companies, they don't explain these things to you on purpose. so that you stay in debt. If someone had explained to me how an interest rate actually works on a credit card, how that stuff comes back to bite you in the butt every single month you don't pay it off, I might not have signed up for that credit card. But again, I didn't know how those things worked. No one told me the definition of these things. And it's way easier to get into debt than to understand it and get out of it. And a system is built against us in that way.
It's true. And people put down math classes, unfortunately. They really, this is the opportunity. And I'm talking, they should be teaching this in fifth grade, sixth grade.
Yes.
All of this, the kids should already know. And of course, one of the things, and I think, I don't know where kids are getting their money from, but they have to learn. They have to learn responsibility. I just had to do it myself, you know. But how do you approach young people now and say, look, this is where the money is, and if you want to get out of debt or if you want to have money, there are certain things you have to do.
Well, I would say, I think something that's important to point out, especially with this new generation, Gen Z, but I think this is true for any generation of young people, they know about money. They understand the importance of it. They understand that it's really central to the world that we live in. It's just that no one is teaching them the facts and the basics that they want to, that they need to know. And if they are being taught, they're being taught in these like really boring, stale, just like, ugh, kind of ways. And so what I'm working to do with Money Out Loud, with my social content on the internet, is try to make these lessons fun. Try to make them enjoyable and relatable. Talk about our cultures and money. Talk about our gender and money. How money affects our families. How money, how religion affects our money. Try to sort of contextualize it so that it's not just I'm coming down at you with these lessons you're supposed to know, but hey, let's come from this place where I can relate to you. How money feels. You money feels on social media, how money is talked about amongst your favorite celebrities and things like that. I just think the education needs to come a little closer to young people. I can't blame them for tuning out when someone's talking to them about money, because the way that we talk about it is so boring and so shameful and just so kind of negative and toxic sometimes. So I think we need to just loosen up when it comes to financial education. We got to start using more imagery, more metaphors, more fun, more games, more engagement. That's what I hope to do with my book, with Money Out Loud.
Well, it is very well written and organized so that people can go through the different sections and learn as they're reading. And you're also very funny. And you have nice.
Oh, thank you.
You have a nice. It's a nice sort of cheerful attitude that, yes, you can learn this, which I think is important when it comes to money. But you have details there about bank accounts and saving money and credit cards and student loans. I mean, this, I do not understand why the students of America have not had an uprising where it comes to the increase in educational costs. It is ridiculous. It is there's no excuse for what they're charging at universities today, because university are spending fortunes on the president's salary and all of that kind of stuff. And if you take, it's the amount that they are charging students to go to school is ridiculous.
100%. I mean, it's very much education, just like healthcare in this country, unfortunately, it's not given. It's not universal. It's a business. These are business models. Now our education kind of centers, our schools and our hospitals and our insurance companies, their focus is making money. It's not education and it's not care. It's making money. And that's the sad reality of living inside of capitalism in the U.S. And so that's why it's incredibly so much more important that we teach young people how our money world works, because as much as we'd like to believe that, colleges want you to learn and hospitals want you to be healed, that's just not the way it is. When we believe that, that's when we get into situations of debt that we didn't expect. That's how we get hit with these bills that we didn't understand. The more we understand how the world actually works financially, the better we can protect ourselves and the better we can stay financially free.
Absolutely. Now, how do people, of course, the book is online, and it's called Money Out Loud, All the Financial Stuff No One Taught Us. And where do you have a website also where you have more information for people?
Yes, absolutely. My website is heyberna.com.
Hey Berna.
H-E-Y-B-E-R-N-A. Hey me, exactly. And you could find me on Instagram, especially, and Twitter and YouTube and TikTok, also at Hey Berna.
Well, Hey Berna, I think your information is really so relevant and so important. I hope that people will get this. And it's coming up to graduation. And this is a perfect time to give this book as a gift to every graduate. Really, they shouldn't let... You know, if a high school was smart, instead of some of the nonsense that they spend their money on, buy this book for every graduate. This, give them the diploma in one hand, and in the other hand, give them money out loud and say, "Hey, Berna, we're
oh my God!
Wouldn't that be fantastic?
That would be my fantasy. That would be my fantasy. I hope.
No,
yes, I hope that there are principals listening right now who will do that exact thing. I'm ready for it.
I'm telling you. And parent associations at high schools, get together because you always raise funds. We used to raise funds, you know, for Latin Club, and we'd have sell cupcakes and we'd do all of this kind of stuff and have toga parties. In this case, the parents should get together. They should have some kind of a fundraising thing so that every graduate, everyone, when they graduate in May and June and they walk up there, they get their diploma, they get money out loud. How about that?
That is, now that we're speaking it into existence, I really hope that there are principals, parent-teacher associations that are listening. I'm ready. Email me, DM me on Instagram. I would love to work something out where it's just, I love this image. Diploma in one hand, money out loud in the other. This is my dream. We're going to make it happen.
Well, first of all, do a photo op of that. Make a sort of scene out of it. And then tell the parents that you will come personally to their event. Sign books. So not only will they get the benefit of, you know, raising funds for the book, they'll be able to give autographed books to the kids graduating. Huh?
Okay. Oh, sorry. I think we disconnected for a second there.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said. You go to these events, you sign the books, and they can give autographed books to the kids. How about that?
I would absolutely love that. I'd be very, anyone listening, I'm extremely willing to figure this out with my publicist and my publisher. Let's just get into it.
Okay, great. Bye-bye now, Berna. Bye.
Thank you so much, Patsy.
Okay. Okay, everybody, remember what I always say. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. And my goodness, my sister spent all day yesterday with Carol J. Perry. Just my sister, Natalie, is a connoisseur of cozy mysteries, and she just had a ball yesterday with one. Well, we'll talk about it more because she's going to be rating this new Carol Perry book that's going to be coming out. It's in pre-order today. Go to her website and go to her Facebook page because you can get it there. Barnes & Noble, pre-order Carol J. Perry's book and 25% off. Now, that is a heck of a sale, 25% off, and including audible books. And meanwhile, I'll say something nice to Big Ed in the control room because he's getting nervous and he's saluting me, and I have to salute him because I should have been a general. Bye-bye, everybody.